ladies and gentlemen, this is People's Question Time. I'm your host, Roderick Gates. I'll begin with 10 to 15 minutes for you reviewing some of the latest events today, from Melbourne to Washington, etc. Afterwards, I invite you, listeners, to call us on our phone-in numbers to speak on what issues I've mentioned or others that you would just think about if you're interested. In Russia, another of Russian President Vladimir Putin's enemies has mysteriously died. On this occasion, he, suspiciously committed suicide by jumping from the Moscow apartment that he lived in. And this has produced, no doubt, a great deal of shock again. This will be, the third or fourth opponent of President Putin, and in the press again, that has mysteriously died. As I have informed the British papers, The Guardian, and The Age here in Australia, the seedy death of a Russian colleague of mine in the Russian press demonstrates ever-deteriorating conditions for which journalists operate in Russia. Organizations dedicated to exposing anti-press actions from Botswana to New York City are increasingly denouncing the Russian government for allowing and even possibly producing a dangerous market for assassination of dissenters. The military affairs correspondent of Kommersant newspaper died last Friday after falling from a fourth floor window in Moscow. This is in claims of incitement suicide after journalist falls to his death in The Independent by Andrew Osborne in Moscow on the 7th of March 2007. The Guardian's dedication to publication of unwelcome thoughts is a valued contribution to British liberty, but the story Indonesian plane crash kills 22 by Ian McKinnon should surely be published alongside a no less despicable outcome of travels into the realm of international arms deals between Russia and Iran, something Ilya Bulanov had delved in too deep, it seems, for the FSB to allow any longer. I myself have been in contact with this man. I last emailed him last December. It was just on the issue of arms deals, actually. It was the last question I had for him, and I asked him just basically, will you research into this if there are any developments, and he said, well, we'll see. So this has been another spooky week, and not just for politicians who are now, many of which in South America, are gathering for a visit by U.S. President George W. Bush, whose first stop is to visit President Lula of Brazil, but also for journalists, as another leads mixed in suspicious circumstances in Russia once again. There haven't been many references, like in the press lately, concerning Arab nationalism, like in the Middle East, though it has been a great deal in the 20th century. And it hasn't been well discussed of Israel's use by the U.S. as a counterweight to radical Arab nationalism, the extent of deliberately keeping the Arab world divided, as in a declassified policy paper prepared by the National Security Council Planning Board in the U.S., commenting on the memorandum. There's issues arising out of situation in the Near East, July 29 of 1958, by in foreign relations with the United States, 1958-60, in Near East region, Iraq, Iran, Arabian Peninsula, and Washington, U.S. Government Print Press, 1993, that's even closer. The exact words are, if we choose to combat radical Arab nationalism and to hold Persian Gulf oil by force, if necessary, a logical corollary would be to support Israel as the only strong pro-West power left in the Middle East. This is internal discussion note in the U.S. government. the memorandum identifying Arab nationalism as inimical to Western interests is National Security Council Memorandum 581/1, statement by the National Security Council of long-range U.S. policy towards the Near East in January 24, 1958, in Foreign Relations of the United States, 1958-60, in the same source. An excerpt on pages 18, 20 to 22 and 31 is, "The Near East is of great strategic, political and economic importance to the free world. The area contains the greatest petroleum resources in the world and essential facilities for the interest of military forces and free world commerce. The strategic resources are of such importance to the free world, particularly Western Europe, that it is in the security interest of the United States to make every effort to ensure that these resources will be available and will be used for strengthening the free world." Of course, note that this is at the time of the Cold War. "Current conditions of and political trends in the Near East are inimical to Western interests. In the eyes of the majority of Arabs, the United States appears to be opposed the realization of the goals of Arab nationalism. They believe that the United States is seeking to protect its interests in Near East oil by supporting the status quo and opposing political or economic progress. The mystique of Arab unity has become a basic element of Arab political thought. Our economic and cultural interests in the area have led, not unnaturally, to close U.S. relations with elements in the Arab world whose primary interest lies in the maintenance of relations with the West and the status quo in their countries. These relations have contributed to a widespread belief in the area that the United States desires to keep the Arab world disunited, and it is committed to work with reactionary elements to that end. The USSR, on the other hand, is not inhibited in proclaiming all-out support for Arab unity and for the most extreme Arab nationalist aspirations, because it has no stake in the economic and political status quo in the area. The area's indigenous institutions and religions lack vigor, partly as a result of the impact of nearly 200 years of Western culture." Another interesting honest admission. "And native resistance to communism per se has therefore been disappointing. Furthermore, communist police state methods," this is an interesting one as well, "seem no worse than similar methods employed by Near East regimes, including some of those supported by the United States." It's an expression of justification. "Where the United States and its friends seek a level of stability in the area to permit peaceful and economic and social progress, nationalist Arabs and Soviets need continuing chaos in order to pursue their separate aims. They believe that our concern over Near East petroleum is essential to the Western alliance. Our desires to create indigenous strength to resist communist subversion or domination, our efforts to maintain existing military transit and base rights and deny them to the USSR are a mere cover for a desire to divide and dominate the area. Of the countries covered by this paper, only Israel will be capable of effective delaying action against a military power. The United States should be prepared, when required, to come forward, as was done in Iran in the CIA coup of 1953, with formulas designed to reconcile vital free world interests in the area's petroleum resources with the rising tide of nationalism in the area." So there's something that you won't hear much in the press, I'm sure, because it's too honest. And right to freedom of speech, including the interesting development of the conviction of three self-described demonstrators, who are literally agitators, against the Danish cartoons satirizing the Islamic prophet Muhammad, and being convicted for agitation and so on, is another indicator of the need both for freedom of speech and protection of the public from possible violent agitators. Though freedom of speech, unfortunately, in Britain isn't officially recognised, the manner of speaking has it by the back door by being signatory to the European Convention on Human Rights, which of course includes the right to freedom of speech section. But officially, Britain does not have it and never has had the right to freedom of speech. There was a British police raid on the BBC and freedom of speech in England, for example, like in, as it's been documented by Geoffrey Robinson's Freedom, the Individual of the Law, London, published by Penguin in the 7th edition, 993, a guide to citizens' rights and an up-to-the-minute account of civil liberties and lack of them in Britain. This is what he said in 965, 96, and 275. The Official Secrets Act remarkably offers remarkably extensive powers of search and seizure, which sidesteps some of the safeguards in PACE, the Police and Criminal Evidence Act. This came dramatically to public attention in 1987 when the Special Branch officers raided the BBC offices in Glasgow and seized all master tapes of Duncan Campbell's Secret Society series, raided the homes of three New Statesmen journalists, and spent over 4 days examining files in the offices of that magazine. The whole episode related to Duncan Campbell's exposure of Project Zikron, a £5 million spy satellite being planned by the Ministry of Defence to put Britain in the business of eavesdropping from space. The government's case for suppression was undermined both by the fact that the project seemed to be common knowledge amongst defence contractors and by the impossibility of keeping the satellite a secret from the Russians once it was launched. The Home Secretary's power to ban broadcasts was invoked in 1988 for the purpose of direct political censorship. When the BBC and IBA were ordered not to transmit any interviews with representatives from Sinn Féin, the Ulster Defence Association, or the IRA, or any statement which incited support for such groups, the ban is a serious infringement on the rights to receive and impart information. It prevents representatives of lawful political parties, Sinn Féin has an MP and 60 local councillors, from stating their case on matters which have no connection with terrorism, and it denies to the public the opportunity to see and hear those who support violent action being questioned and exposed. The ban prevents the re-screening of such excellent programs as Robert Key's Ireland, A Television History, or Thames Television's The Troubles, which contain interviews with IRA veterans. See also, bid to prosecute Rushdie is rejected in the New York Times of April 10, 1990, page C16, in it which said, England's High Court today rejected a Muslim group's request to prosecute Salman Rushdie and the publishers of his novel The Satanic Verses on charges of blasphemy and seditious libel. The court upheld a ruling that England's blasphemy law applied only to Christianity, not to other religions, including Islam. The judges agreed that for seditious libel to be proven, the evidence must show that it did not, that an attack was made against Her Majesty or Her Majesty's government or some other institution of the state. The last prosecution for blasphemy in England was 1979, when a magazine in Gay News, the magazine Gay News, was convicted under the law of publishing a poem that depicted Jesus as a homosexual. So in Britain, amongst other things, not only can does the government maintain a ban on interviews with the IRA and so on, they still have a law as disgraceful as a blasphemy law, originated in the 1600s or so. Yes, initiated under Henry VIII. Where a Christian can sue someone because they found what they said religiously offensive. Well, that's a huge attack on freedom of speech, I think, and should be repealed. There are cases, thankfully, like in the U.S. Supreme Court, regarding freedom of speech. In manner of speaking, while the First Amendment was both the first and a very early amendment to the U.S. Constitution, it wasn't until the 1960s that it was fully upheld. So it was just on a scrap of paper, in a manner of speaking, treated as so. On free speech cases in the U.S. Supreme Court, see, for example, Harry Calvin's A Worthy Tradition, Freedom of Speech in America, in New York, Harper and Rowles, 1988. An excerpt on page XV is, "The First Amendment has been part of the Constitution and of American life since 1791. Yet it was only during World War I that the process of defining freedom of speech by means of judicial review really got started. As of the cutoff date of this book, 1974, more than 50% of all First Amendment cases have been decided since 1959. In other words, more than half were the work of the Warren Court. The Sedition Act of 1 Stat. 596 and of the year 1798, and the Public Statutes at Large of the United States of America from the Organization of Government in 1789 to March 3, 1845, in Boston, Little Brown, 1848, Volume 1, page 596, published by authority of Congress, provided in part, that if any person shall write, print, utter, or publish, or shall cause to procure to be written, printed, uttered, or published, or shall knowingly assist in or aid in writing, printing, uttering, or publishing any false, scandalous, or malicious writings, or writings against the government of the United States, or either House of Congress or the United States, with intent to defame the said government, or either House of the said Congress or the said President, to bring them or either of them into contempt or disrepute, or to excite against them or either any of them the hatred of the good people of the United States, then such a person, being thereof convicted before any court of the United States having jurisdiction thereof, shall be punished by fine not exceeding $2,000 and any imprisonment not exceeding 2 years." So that's what the Sedition Act was used against a presidential candidate, Eugene Debs, for saying that Woodrow Wilson violated election pledge promise by bringing the U.S. into the First World War, and for that he was arrested and thrown in jail. For commentary, I see Harry Calvin's A Worthy Tradition, Freedom of Speech in America and New York of 1988. From page 64, he says, "An apparent qualification on the face of the act as to falsify and malice were illusory, since under the common law of defamation, if a statement was judged defamatory, malice and falsity were assumed, leaving the burden of proof on the defendant. When Jefferson came to power in 1800, he pardoned the violators still in jail. On prosecutions under the Sedition Act, see, for example, Leonard Levy's Emergence of a Free Press, published by New York and Oxford University Press, 1985. There was an entire corpus of prosecutions for seditious libel under the Sedition Act of 1798. President Adams willingly signed the Sedition Act and eagerly urged its enforcement, and Crushing, then an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, presided over some of the trials and charged juries on the constitutionality of the statute. The Sedition Act, the capstone of the new federalist system, expressed the easy rule of thumb offered by the party organ in the nation's capital. He that is not for us is against us. Incapable of distinguishing dissent from disloyalty, the federalists easily resorted to legal coercion to control public opinion for party purposes. In the memorandum of 1801, President Jefferson dismissed the prosecution initiated under his predecessor against William Duane, the Republican editor of the Philadelphia Aurora, who had been indicted under the Sedition Act. Yet the hard fact remains, Jefferson, Madison, Gallatin, Livingston, Nicholas, and Mackin explicitly endorsed the power of the states to prosecute the seditious libel and other criminal libels. They are endorsed the basic concept of the criminal responsibility of the writer or printer for abuse of his rights, or they failed to oppose it. David Carey's freedom of speech in David Carey's editorial of Politics of Law, a Progressive Critique, is also pretty good, published by Pantheon in 1982. There's a revised, expanded edition for 1990. Excerpt from page 242 is, the most prominent person prosecuted under the Sedition Act was Matthew Lyon, a member of Congress, critical of the Federalists, the governing political party. Lyon was imprisoned and his house sold to pay his fine. Nevertheless, he was re-elected in the next election. The longest prison term, 2 years, was served by a laborer for erecting a sign on a post that read, in part, no stamp act, no sedition, downfall of to the tyrants of America, peace and retirement to the president. On a similar note, Thomas Jefferson is regarded as a great libertarian and so on by Americans. Well, he was, but after he was in power. When he was in power, he was just about as authoritarian as Robert Mugabe. On Thomas Jefferson's view on corporations, for example, as well as the effect of economic inequality on democracy. See, for example, John F. Manley's American Liberalism and the Democratic Dream, Transcending the American Dream, published by Policy Studies Review in 1980. The excerpt from, interesting excerpt from pages 97 to 99 is, Jefferson did not support capitalism. He supported independent production. The fundamental Jeffersonian proposition is that widespread poverty and concentrated wealth cannot exist side by side in a democracy. This proposition was dismissed by liberals making peace with the rich and coming to terms with inequality, but Jefferson perceived the basic contradictions between democracy and capitalism. In 1817, he complained that the banks' mania is raising up a moneyed aristocracy in our country, which has already set the government at defiance. A year earlier, he said he hoped that the United States would reject the British example and crush in its birth the aristocracy of our moneyed corporations, which dare already to challenge our government to a trial of strength and bid defiance to the laws of our country. Jefferson understood that democracy was problematic, but the alternatives were rule by the rich or a despot. I'm not among those who fear the people, he writes. They, and not the rich, are our dependents for continued freedom. Show me where the people have done half the mischief in these 40 years that a single despot would have done in a single year. Jefferson reminds us that democracy is impossible without large measure of social and economic equality. Charles Sellers, in The Market Revolution of Jeffersonian America of 1815-46, in New York Oxford University Press, 1991, is pretty good. Jefferson's deathbed faith overcame deep misgivings. Men naturally divide into two parties, aristocrats and Democrats, he wrote. On one side stood those who fear and distrust the people and wish to draw all powers from them into the hands of the higher classes. On the other stood those who identify with the people, have confidence in them, cherish and consider them as the honest and safe, although not the most wise, depository of the public interests. He was alarmed by the Republican Congress at a loss for objects whereupon to throw away the supposed fathomless funds of the Treasury. Soon he would conclude that these younger national Republicans have nothing in them of the feelings or principles of 76. They wanted a single and splendid government of an aristocracy founded on banking institutions and moneyed in corporations. He complained through which the few would soon be riding and ruling over the plundered ploughmen and the begging yeomanry. Well, that was 1860, and not much has changed too much since then, I would say. There is, in the case like in Thomas Jefferson, further, that U.S. They weren't really very pressed with the outbreak of the Civil War and the United States' almost immediate habit of attacking its neighbors like Mexico in the 1800s, almost immediately. James Madison made an interesting general critique against war. Of all the enemies of true liberty, war is perhaps the most to be dreaded because it comprises and develops the germ of every other. War is the parent of armies. From these proceed debts and taxes, and armies and debts and taxes are known to be instruments for bringing the many under the domination of a few. In war, too, the discretionary power of the executive is extended. Its influence in dealing out offices, honors, and annulments is multiplied, and all the means of seducing the minds are added to those of subduing the force of the people. The same malignant aspect of republicanism may be traced to the inequality of fortunes and the opportunities of fraud growing out of a state of power, of state of war, and the degeneracy of manner and of morals engendered in both. No nation can preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare. War is, in fact, the true nurse of executive aggrandizement. In war, a physical force is needed to be created, and it is the executive will which is to direct it. In war, the public treasuries are to be unlocked, and it is the executive hand which is to dispense them. In war, the honors and annulments of office are to be multiplied, and it is the executive patronage under which they are to be enjoyed, and it is the executive brow they are to encircle. The strongest passions and most dangerous weaknesses of the human breast, ambition, avarice, vanity, the honorable or venal love of fame, are all in conspiracy against the desire and duty of peace. Now, though there has been a interesting example, like of George Bush and WMDs in Iraq, of the regular use of bogeymen and crises and enemies out there about to attack us that we must attack today or they'll attack us tomorrow. A very untrue and interesting one, though pretty silly, is in the 1980s regarding the Libya. In the 1980s, as some of you might recall, U.S. President Reagan was hiding in the White House, surrounded by tanks, because Libyan hitmen were supposedly prowling the streets of Washington about to assassinate our leader. And Ronald Reagan somehow managed to have a press conference without any of the journalists being assassinated and said, "I remember this man called Winston Churchill. He said he'll never give up. I will never give up. I will fight until the end," and so on. For some of the lunatic disinformation stories about Libya, keeping only to a single journalist's coverage. See, for example, Michael Reins' Uniting Against Libya in Newsweek, October 19, 1981, page 43. Newsweek has also learned that Gaddafi is ordering the assassination of the U.S. ambassador to Italy. U.S. intelligence also picked up evidence that Gaddafi has hatched yet another assassination plot, this time against President Reagan. Say, Willie Gaddafi's latest plot in Newsweek, October 9, 1981, page 29. It said, U.S. intelligence believes that Libyan strongman Muammar Gaddafi is planning terrorist attacks on four American embassies in Western Europe. This continues to build up. John Breacher, New Threats from Gaddafi, in Newsweek, November 30, 1981, the same year, but later in the year, page 51, said senior American officials told Newsweek Gaddafi's talk appears to be more than bluster. These officials say Gaddafi has expanded his hit list to include Vice President George Bush, Secretary of State Alexander Haig, and Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger, and that he has equipped special assassination squads with bazookas, grenade launchers, and even portable SAM 7 missiles capable of bringing down the president's plane. Gaddafi hit squad at large, Newsweek, December 14, 1981, page 36. An assassination squad dispatched by Libyan strongman Muammar Gaddafi entered the United States. In David M. Alpern's Coping with a Plot to Kill the President, in Newsweek, in December 21, 1981, page 16. Security around President Reagan has tightened amid intelligence reports that placed his potential assassins either in the country or on its borders preparing to strike. See also James Kelly's Searching for Hit Teams. There was no proof, but there was sufficient reason to believe. In Time magazine, in December 21, same day, 1981, page 16, summing up the status of the hitman story in its title, but nonetheless continuing its publicity, basically engaging in gossip and fear-mongering. Duncan Campbell, unfortunately, the press swallowed this at the time. The U.S. press swallowed it. Duncan Campbell and Patrick Forbes in Tale of Anti-Reagan Hit Team was fraud in the New Statesman, in the British paper. So the British press was able to pick this out as nonsense. In August 16, 1985, page 6, reporting that a secret official U.S. list of 14 alleged Libyan terrorists was in fact a list of prominent members of the Lebanese Shiite party, Amal, including its leader, Nabin Berri, and the religious leader of the Lebanese Shiite community, with most of the rest just being aging Lebanese politicians. To compound the absurdity, the ML party is passionately anti-Libyan. On a later Reagan administration claim that Libya was planning to overthrow the government of the Sudan. Another interesting example, there is Bernard Gritson's Schultz asserts Libyan threat has receded in the New York Times, February 21, 1983, so 2 years later, page A1. Which said, the Secretary of State, George P. Schultz, said today that the Reagan administration believed last week was a military threat by Libya against the Sudan had now receded. Mr. Schultz, in his television appearance, said the President of the United States acted quickly and decisively and effectively, and at least for the moment, Gaddafi is back in his box where he belongs. His comments were in line with the White House effort Friday and Saturday to convince reporters privately that Mr. Reagan was actually in charge of the operation, even though at his news conference on Wednesday he made factual errors. Administration officials have said the AWACS that attacked Libya were sent at the explicit request of President Mubarak, but Egyptian officials and news organizations have denied in recent days that any such request was made, or that any threat to the Sudan exists. The Libyans have denied any plans to attack the Sudan across 600 miles of desert. The lack of any tangible threat from Libya was reminiscent of the administration's problems in late 1981. This is looking back, when it aroused considerable agitation in Washington over reports of a Libyan hit squad being sent to the United States to try to kill high officials. Nothing happened, and it was unclear whether the publicity forced cancellation of the Libyan plans or whether the administration's information was faulty in the first place. For a later exposure of some of the U.S. government's disinformation campaigns, see Jonathan Alter in A Bodyguard of Lies, Newsweek, October 13, 1986, page 43, which said, in August, National Security Advisor John Poindexter sent President Reagan a memo outlining what Poindexter called a disinformation program aimed at destabilizing leader Gaddafi by generating false reports that the United States and Libya were again on a collision course. Evidence that the disinformation campaign was underway turned up on August 25th in the Wall Street Journal. We relied on high-level officials who hyped some of this, Wall Street Journal Washington Bureau Chief Albert Hunt says. The lies were profoundly disturbing, even to journalists hardened by a lifetime of covering dissembling officials. Edward P. Haley's Gaddafi in the United States since 1969, in New York Prager, 1984, page 257-64, bitterly anti-Gaddafi study, summarizes the various stages of the propaganda campaign designed to discredit the Libyan leader and turn him into an international outlaw, making a praiseworthy effort to make the comedy take it seriously. On a similar note, but more truthful, like on what will be the best ways, surely, to combat Islamic jihadists, but more sober and proper on a similar issue, is I'm basically quoting, the problem with the war in Iraq is that it provides very welcome material for those who argue that America and her allies are fundamentally opposed to any kind of unity and prosperity in the Islamic world. The Islamic militants see their struggle, I think this is wrong because of late expense, see their struggle as a defensive one. They believe that they are resisting a tradition of belligerence and aggression by the West that goes back to the Crusades. Unfortunately, attacking, however justifiably or not, two Islamic nations in the space of 2 years, one of which is the cultural heart of many Islamic or Muslims or an Arab's cultural identity, that clearly is going to provide evidence for those who believe in that worldview. The point here is that if you accept that bin Laden and his close aides are not solely responsible for global terrorism, and that far more profound and widespread factors are at work, involving ideology, worldviews, a way of seeing international relations, relations between the West and Islam, because there are plenty of Libyans who are Muslims, I'm sure, and so forth. Even though you may have halted a potential threat, you've created something that's far more dangerous by doing so. I think the term Al-Qaeda, particularly now, is of dubious use when trying to describe the phenomenon of contemporary Islami Sunni Muslim militancy. Al-Qaeda is commonly perceived to be a tight-knit terrorist organization led by bin Laden. Something like that comes close to that description existed in Afghanistan around between 1997 and 2001. That entity no longer exists. What we have now is something far more diverse, a whole series of groups, cells, and even individuals who are dissimilar in many ways, but are united by certain fundamental ideological ideas and a particular way of viewing the world. Broadly, if you want or if you need an Al-Qaeda as a label, then I think it should be applied to that broad movement rather than one specific group. And I think if you continue to conceive of the threat from militant Islam as coming from one specific group, then attempts to end that threat are likely to be misjudged as a result. And tactics based on this assumption could at very best prolong the war against terror or as a victorious war against terror, and the worst could be counterproductive. That's Jason Burke, the author of Al-Qaeda Casting a Shadow of Terror. He's the number one specialist on, he spent all his life on the Islamic jihadism. As he said in a Bush Flash interview in October 9, 2003, as Burke reviews a Clinton's 1998 bombing of Sudan and Afghanistan created bin Laden as a symbol, forged close relations between him and the Taliban, and led to a sharp increase in support, recruitment, and financing for Al-Qaeda, which till then was virtually unknown. the next major contribution of growth of al-Qaeda and the prominence of bin Laden was Bush's bombing of Afghanistan following September 11, undertaken without credible pretext, as later quietly conceded. As a result, bin Laden's message spread among tens of millions, particularly the young and angry around the world. Burke writes, reviewing the increase in global terror and creation of a whole new cadre of terrorists, and this in what they see as a cosmic struggle between good and evil, a vision shared by bin Laden and Bush. As noted, the invasion of Iraq had the same anticipated effect. Burke concludes, every use of force is a small victory for bin Laden, who is winning whether he lives or dies. Burke's assessment is widely shared by many analysts, including former heads of Israeli military intelligence and the General Security Services. We can help the vanguard mobilize this reservoir of support by violence, or can address the myriad grievances, many legitimate, that are the root causes of modern Islamic militancy that can significantly reduce the threat of terror and should be undertaken independently of this goal. The Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories is the number one issue in the Middle East. Addressing that would absolutely pull the plug on this terrible swamp that's been growing a great deal. There was, like, in the 20th century, on a similar note regarding India, U.S. opposition to the development of India post-independence. On U.S. leaders' dislike of Nehru and Indian independence, see, for example, Robert J. McMahon's The Cold War on the Periphery, United States, India, and Pakistan, in New York, Columbia University Press, 1994, discussing high U.S. officials' dislike of Indian independence, and quoting their remarks that Nehru was a spoiled child, a vain and immature, a hypersensitive egoist, motivated by a terrible resentment of domination by whites, intellectually arrogant, and of course at the same time suffering from an inferiority complex, schizophrenia, and that all Indians are notably prone to blame others for their problems, as the British know all too well, and Indian ingratitude is due to a sense of divine right that is a sort of natural attribute of Indians, so as both a racist and developmental attitude towards the Indians as just after they gained independence from Britain. There were New York Times articles about the anti-development attitude of the U.S. towards India specifically, like J. Anthony Lucas's Mrs. Gandhi and the Left criticism by Menon reflects her drift to pragmatism in the New York Times, April 29, 1966, page 6 in an excerpt. The government of India has granted easy terms to private foreign investors in the fertilizer industry, is thinking about decontrolling several more industries, and is ready to liberalize import policy if it gets sufficient foreign aid. Much of what is happening now is a result of steady pressure from the United States and the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development. The United States' pressure, in particular, has been highly effective here and provides by far the largest part of foreign exchange needed to finance India's development and keep the wheels of industry turning. Call them strings, call them conditions, or whatever you like. India has little choice now but to agree to many of the terms that the United States through the World Bank is putting on its aid, for India simply has nowhere else to turn. Mrs. Gandhi denies she is sharing socialism in Prime Minister Cole's charge of yielding to West absurd, which was put in the New York Times, April 25, 1966. Again, Anthony Lucas's India and U.S. concerned signed fertilizer plant pact in the New York Times, May 15, 1966, section 1, page 18. See also Derek K. Willis's Indo-U.S. relations strained by political complexities, like in the Christian Monitor of November 26, 1966, page 5, which he wrote, the White House does not consider that New Delhi is doing nearly enough to attract foreign capital to build private chemical fertilizer plants, the sine qua non of better food production. So the president is hoarding up approval of the 2 million tons of grain India says it must have by the end of the year. For their part, Indian officials here and in New Delhi do not hide their near exasperation with Washington. We have done everything we can to attract foreign capital for fertilizer plants, they say in effect. But the American and other Western private companies know that we are over a barrel, so they demand stringent terms. We just cannot meet them. Meanwhile, the 2 million tons promised us months ago is not loaded soon. There will be a gap in the pipeline of food act, and the consequences will be very bad indeed. Note that partly in this period, there was a near famine in India. I think we know who can be partially held responsible for that, given these attempts to squeeze the Indian government of the 1960s, late 1960s. Regarding the development of India. On a much distant note, but this time we'll focus on public perception. The former House Speaker of the House of Representatives, Newt Gingrich, just about as you couldn't necessarily call him right wing, he's in another universe. Never had as much popular support as he would like to say, say with accuracy. He never had the majority support on just about any policy you can think of that he advocates even today. Not that Sean Hannity and Combs will roast him alive on it. There was measurement of public knowledge and attitudes towards his contract with America. The policy program advanced in 1994 when the Republicans gained control of the U.S. Congress. Like in Maureen Dowd's, Americans like GOP agenda, but split in how to reach goals. In the New York Times, December 15, 1994, in page A1, although Mr. Gingrich has been waving around his copy of the contract with America, which was printed in TV Guide, 72%. Of those polled by the New York Times and CBS News said they had not read or heard anything about it. Mark Brelso's the GOP's 17% mandate. In dollars and cents, March 1, 1995, page 43. John Brennan, the director of the Los Angeles Times poll, said voters don't buy expert wisdom that economy is perking along. In Los Angeles Times, November 29, 1994, page D2, which is this October, as the Republican blowout was brewing, 61% still told the Times poll that spending for domestic programs should be increased. Most, including GOP-leaning voters, had never heard of the now legendary Republican contract with America. When told it was a mix of tax cuts, more defense spending and a balanced budget amendment, a majority called it unrealistic. Richard Moran, the director of the Washington Post poll, emits some messages to the election tea leaves. Washington Post National Weekly Edition, on November 21 to 27, 1994, page 37, as the public opinion polls and analysis of 1994 congressional election returns suggest that the vote was something less than what Newt Gingrich and his fellow travelers appeared to have in store for the country. According to a Time magazine CNN post-election survey, 6 out of 10 persons interviewed said that the election was a repudiation of the Democrats, while just 1 out of 6 said it was an affirmation of the Republican agenda. Republicans claimed about 52% of all votes cast for candidates in contested House seats, slightly better than a 2-point improvement from 1992. Richard Burke in poll finds public doubts key parts of GOP's agenda in the New York Times, February 28, 1995, A1. An excerpt, pay 8 weeks after Republicans assumed control of Congress and vowed to make the government more responsive, Americans are dubious about central elements of the party's legislative agenda. More than half of Americans said they knew nothing about the contract with America, the House Republicans' political manifesto. But the number of people who had some familiarity with the contract had risen to 45% from 27% in December. Even so, Americans, Democrats, Republicans alike disagreed with or were divided over many particulars in the contract. Despite the contract's call to increase military spending, 63% preferred to keep such spending at the current level. 69% of Americans said it was a poor idea for the House to approve, as it did recently, a bill that would allow the police to make searches without having a warrant. For one of the most fascinating stories about the so-called contract, see Knight Ritter's GOP pollster, Never Measured Popularity of Contract, Only Slogans, in the Chicago Tribune, November 12, 1995, page 7, Zone C, that said, after recent polls that suggested contract with America's popularity had fallen, House Speaker Newt Gingrich blamed pollsters for asking totally dishonest questions. There may be another explanation. Republican pollster Frank Luntz, a Gingrich protege, never really measured the contract's popularity in the first place before assuring reporters last September that at least 6 out of 10 Americans supported each of its 10 main proposals. Instead, in a survey he won't disclose for publication, Luntz merely measured the popularity of the strongest slogans that the contract's drafters could come up with. Luntz now concedes that his methods were flawed. And even some Republicans suspect that public support for the contract was overstated. This month's Wall Street Journal NBC News survey, for example, finds that by 45% to 35% margin, the public disagrees with most of what the House GOP is proposing to do. And the U.S. people won't change their views, like on welfare versus assistance to the poor. See, for example, Nancy Faubourg's Welfare State of Mind, Village Voice Literary Supplement, November 1992, page 31. Even many fair-minded, kind-hearted, ordinary people have become persuaded that welfare is a cause of poverty, not means of coping with it. The best evidence of this comes from a poll recently published in the New York Times. When asked whether we are spending too much, too little, or about right on welfare, 44% of all respondents said too much, and 23% said too little. When the phrase assistance to the poor was substituted for welfare, the percentage who said too much dropped to 13%. The percentage who said too little increased to 64%. So the welfare, unfortunately, has become a bit of a swear word. However, when you reduce that very narrow phrase to assistance for the poor, well, that there's massive increased support for it. Like in Jason D. Powell's, the 1994 election issues, momentum builds for cutting back welfare system. In the New York Times, November 13, 1994, page 1, the same voters who clamor in opinion polls for a crackdown on welfare spending now show much less support when the issue is defined as reducing aid to the poor, especially poor children. For a study of how the British press and politicians led a successful campaign, to dismantle the welfare consensus in Britain. See Peter Golding's and Sue Middleton's Images of Welfare, Press Public Attitudes to Poverty, published at Oxford by Martin Robinson, 1982. On this issue of welfare versus assistance to the poor, Nancy Faulber's Welfare State of the Mind speaks specifically on this. I could be repeating myself since I double typed. So yes, I'm sure that when the Democrats last November received a huge surge of votes, they may have deceived themselves in how much public support they have, like on particular policies. They don't intend to pursue an immediate withdrawal from Iraq, and they pursue more scrutiny and so on, using the phrase new agenda or new perception and increased scrutiny. That doesn't buy votes. That only increases the indignation, I'm sure, and not just of U.S. citizens, but also foreigners outside the U.S. who felt they were misled, particularly when the Republicans obviously deliberately exaggerated how extremists and radical the Democrats were in the election. Nancy Pelosi, I've heard a beep then, so I believe we're just running out of time, ladies and gentlemen. I thank you for listening, and I hope you are able to listen next week. Thank you, and good night.